It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn some of the cool history of a hot commodity with the author of a new book on the history of the humble Ice Cube. Now, Facebook parent company Meta released Instagram Threads last week. It's a new text-based social media app. It's an attempt to capture, in part, the significant number of Twitter users who are unhappy with changes made to the platform since its acquisition by Elon Musk. Threads is not the first social media platform to try to entice Twitter users, but so far it seems to be the most successful. Over the weekend, it hit 100 million signups already. Our next guest is here to talk about what Threads has to offer compared to Twitter and other alternatives and how likely it is to come out on top and what it all means for your social media experience. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're curious about this Threads thing, want to figure out if it's right for you, our guest has not one, not two, but three Threads accounts already. If you have been a Twitter user now or in the past, have you noticed changes since Elon Musk entered the picture? Have you been looking for an alternative? Have you tried Threads? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on a different platform, the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve Knoll is a digital marketing professor specializing in social media at Madison Area Technical College. Steve, welcome back to the studio.
Great for having me again.
Now, Threads, let's start with the new kid here, Steve. What is it doing? How close is it to Twitter? How is it, if in any significant way, different from a Twitter?
Well, the one thing about Threads is that it's not a standalone social media app. It's actually a offshoot of Instagram. You have to have an Instagram account with the Instagram app, then you can download Threads and then link that to Instagram. So, and the idea is that Instagram is about pictures and video, where Threads is going to be more about text and ideas. And so they're meant to be companion pieces, but of course everybody is talking about, is this the Twitter killer app?
And how? What do you think so far, based on what, a week of usage?
Yeah, not even a week, and they've already surpassed 100 million signups. Mm. So it's been a crazy week. So it definitely has some things in common. You know, the big thing about Twitter, the thing that people have always been attracted to Twitter is a social medium that exists in the right now. When you post on Twitter, you're talking about what is happening at this very moment. A lot of social mediums have a lag time to them. Facebook, for example, if I post something right now, you might see it right now. You might not see it till Saturday. Where Twitter was unique in that, you know, anything over 20 minutes or so was considered old news. And there aren't a lot of other social mediums that operate in that real-time moment. Snapchat is probably the closest thing to it. And that's the big question: why will Threads take off and become the next real-time communication tool?
Now, looking at Twitter, it didn't have the numbers. It never had the numbers of Facebook or Instagram. But we talk about it a lot, I think, because it had an outsized influence, in part because of that immediacy.
Yes.
Can you talk about why we talk about Twitter and what might try to replace it?
Well, and that's the thing is, though, you know, the last time that Twitter reported subscriber numbers, and that was before Elon Musk bought it, it was about 220, 230 million users, which is a very, very large number. But when you consider Instagram as 2 billion users, you know, Twitter was always one-tenth the size of you know, Facebook and Instagram. But that real-time component and the ability to spread the word almost instantly and globally was really an unprecedented tool in the social media arena. And that's the interesting thing is, you know, the last 6 months has been, let's just say, quite interesting watching Twitter. And there has been a question as, you know, Twitter itself is morphing into something different. And even without the rise of Threads, there was question as to whether or not Twitter was sustainable. So it's hard to say that the timing. I think Mark Zuckerberg and Meta lucked out on their timing. Obviously, they didn't just build Threads in 6 months. They've probably been working on this for several years, but they really lucked out in terms of it's the right app at the right time. And I think that is what really translated into this massive growth. But we'll see if it's just a try it and check it out, or if it's going to be an ongoing, I'm going to check it every single day.
Now, what changes have happened at Twitter since Elon Musk bought it that has some users heading for the exit or at least curious enough to try something that does the same sort of stuff?
Well, one of the big things is obviously he has really thrown moderation out the window, you know, and that as a result, there's a lot of it's very complicated to say a lot of, you know, let's just say it, racists.
Yeah, a lot of Nazis.
Really embraced Twitter. All of a sudden they have a platform and they have a person that says, hey, it's okay to be open about being a Nazi, you know, and as a result, they've really gravitated to Twitter. And as a result, advertisers have really ran away, because if you're trying to sell paper towels, do you really want your ad right next to the posting of something that's really racist and offensive? So from a business standpoint, you know, Twitter, in one way, he said, oh, I want it to be the ultimate free speech tool, and it doesn't matter what the speech is. There's going to be stuff you don't like, but I'm not going to censor anything. Of course, he's already censoring stuff that he doesn't like Threads. There were things last week where he was pulling down stuff already, which I had to kind of chuckle. I'm like, well, the ultimate free speech tool is turned into really the ultimate censorship tool.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College, digital marketing professor there, specializing in social media. We are looking at this new social media platform, Threads, a lot of initial interest. Will that grow? Will that persist? And other efforts to replace Twitter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What, if anything, is your social media diet? Were you? Are you a Twitter user? Have you looked to something else? Have you tried Threads already? Mastodon, Blue Sky, another one, a T2. The list goes on and on. Join in at 800-642-1234. Steve, before Threads, I dropped a couple other names there. Mm-hmm. There's this Mastodon. It's a little... I've peeked at it.
I've tried
it. It's a little tricky to get into, but a lot of people, the people who get into it, seem to really like it. It works a little different.
And Blue Sky is another one that is also, you have to get an invitation. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because Blue Sky is being backed by Jack Dorsey, who was one of the CEOs of Twitter before Musk took over. So they're all relatively similar in that they offer a real-time communication platform to, you know, share stuff and talk about stuff. And the whole thing is all really based around this idea of real time. The difference with these other apps is that none of them have really built a critical mass. Blue Sky is probably the biggest competitor, and it's at about 250,000 users. So, you know, Threads is at 100 million users. You know, so when you compare the two of them, it's really hard to get critical mass for like a pop culture moment on such an app that has such small reach. You know, if there's a big moment with a big celebrity and everybody's going online to talk about that, you know, the reach of these smaller apps, it's just not there in order for them to become culturally relevant as a communication tool. I think they want to grow and get there, but they don't really have the backing of something else. You know, Threads had the backing of Instagram, and then obviously Meta, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. That's a lot of backing, and I think that really gave them the leg up. Having said that, though, you know, Threads is starting to reach the end of its thread in terms of what it does, and I think that was on purpose. I think they're going to release a version 2 very soon. It certainly is missing some stuff. You know, Twitter is still a more attractive platform in terms of what it does, but the content on Twitter has just become so toxic, and that's the big question is what's going to happen there.
Now, one thing I think people who like to be on social media sometimes reach a limit of how much they want the whole world to be participating in their conversation. Mm-hmm. They want to sort of make their own community on whatever that platform is and say, yeah, I don't want to see you and you and you on this platform. I just want to see my buddies and this celebrity I'm following or whatever. How customizable, say, is Threads right now to see what somebody wants to see and forget about the rest?
Well, and that's what's missing, is right now when you go on Threads, you only get their curated stream. And that stream is a combination of people that you do follow along with other people that the algorithm figures out that you probably would have an interest in following. So I've been pleasantly happy as how quickly it figured me out and started recommending stuff that I actually am interested in. I was happy that the stuff that I'm seeing is stuff that I'm interested in, and it's not a lot of junk that I have no interest in. However, I'm definitely missing the ability to just say, hey, I just want to talk to my friends. I just want to talk to these small people. You know, Twitter does offer the ability to, you know, you can look at your followers or you can look at their curated stream. Threads only has the curated stream. This is why I'm convinced this is a version one app, because Threads 2.0, which the other question is when will that drop? A week, a month, you know, I think that's the first thing that they'll add to is I think they want people to have, you know, a large built up following initially. Then they're going to introduce the ability to kind of separate those out and saying, hey, do you want the full everything that's out there or do you just want to curate your own community? And I think that'll be next. I just don't know when.
Now, we heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page about Twitter here. Darlene writes, deleted my account the day Elon Musk took over. And John writes, I ditched Twitter the day Elon took over. I don't know. Is there that much visceral reaction just to him, regardless of the changes he made? And are people like loving the warm and cuddly Mark Zuckerberg so much that he's going to draw them to
I want to call Mark Zuckerberg warm and cuddly. Well, no, definitely not.
I'm being a little ironical.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and again, Zuckerberg and the whole Meta company with Facebook and Instagram, they definitely have some, you know, privacy issues that have always been ongoing. I've been on here before talking about this stuff that still needs work. You know, the big thing with Musk taking over Twitter is, you know, he really presented himself as this visionary and this humanist. And then once he got his toy, we really learned a new side of him. And he's really showed his cards in terms of how he really feels. And he's really alienated a lot of people. And I think it's ironic that, you know, his other big company is Tesla, an electric company that probably has an audience base of a lot of progressive-minded people. But yet Elon Musk has absolutely embraced the conservative, radical, racist side. And that's unfortunate that he's really embraced that. You know, it's not even like, you know, I'm going to welcome everybody. He's definitely said, I'm going to welcome everybody, but especially these people. And I think that stuff, A, has absolutely freaked out Madison Avenue in terms of like advertising. And then also it just turned off a lot of people on Twitter. I mean, I'm still on Twitter. I still look at it, but I am probably down to maybe 10% of the time that I spent on it that I was. And a lot of it really is I'm checking Twitter to see how much people are talking about Threads.
We're talking to digital marketing and social media expert Steve Knoll from Madison College, looking at the new Instagram Threads. That's a recently released, in effect, Twitter competitor from Meta. That's the parent company of Facebook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What social media platforms do you use? What have you moved away from? Are you a current or former Twitter user? What do you think of changes there? Have you sought out the new Threads to try it, or Mastodon, or Blue Sky, or the other potential replacements? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with social media expert Steve Knoll from Madison College about the newest, so far in terms of numbers, most successful entry into the ranks of Twitter competitors, Instagram Threads. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How about you? Have you checked out this new Instagram Threads? Are you going to wait and see if friends and family get onto it? If so, does that make you more or less likely to get onto it yourself? What social media do you like? What do you like about social media? What features do you hate about social media? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve, nobody wants to talk to us on the phone about this, but we've heard from some more people online. Marcia wrote, Dear friends, I don't do Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Won't be doing Threads. Facebook is all the aggravation I can handle. And I bet Marcia is not alone. I think probably a lot of people have some level of social media burnout or a ceiling on how much they want to invest their time in social media.
Well, and my question is, I always tell people, you don't need to be on social media. This isn't something you have to do. But there's definitely a social pressure to be on it. But, you know, Facebook is still the biggest social network. There isn't even a close number two. It's not going anywhere. And, you know, it It is designed, you know, for ideas and communication. It's pretty good with video and pictures. It kind of does everything, but, you know, certainly it's not, you know, trendy and exciting. But as a result, Facebook has kind of gravitated to the over 30 audience. But really, that's where the consumers are. And from a money standpoint, I think they're happy about that.
Now, Mark Zuckerberg said something like, talking about Threads here, he'd like a platform like this with a billion or 2 billion people on it. He said something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, with the spread of information as it worked on Twitter with a much smaller number of people, like, is there a sense that a Meta, mm-hmm. right, the Facebook and Instagram company, could sort of track and stop the flow of disinformation on a billion plus platform in a Twitter style?
Well, and that is a big question. The spread of misinformation is an ongoing problem with social media. I think it always will be an ongoing problem. I did have to chuckle over the weekend. I did read some reports about some, let's just say, Nazis who were complaining that they were on Threads and already were getting kicked off. And to me, that kind of made me smile. I'm like, good, because we don't want that stuff on it. And, you know, right now, in order to moderate that stuff, no human being can moderate this stuff. A lot of this moderation has to go through computers first and AI programs doing it. And we've shown that those programs aren't perfect, because a lot of time there's intent behind what is being said. And without that intent, something could be taken out of context. So this is a really complex problem that all the tech companies are working on. So it's always going to be a problem. It's always going to be an issue. Right now, if a big company has to deal with this, I'm glad it's Meta. You know, they're far from perfect. They definitely have issue, but I think that they're the ones that are trying the hardest, even though they're not perfect. You know, and then you only ever hear about when they mess up. You never hear when they succeed. You only hear about when they mess up. But if you really look at their hit to miss ratio, it's pretty good. You know, compared to Twitter, which is basically a dumpster fire at this point. So, again, it's not a problem. Now, again, can they scale this up to 2 billion users? Ooh, you know, that's kind of a freaky thing. But, you know, they're at 100 billion and they haven't, 100 million. Mm-hmm. Add a few zeros. And there have been any, like, reports of outages or crashes, you know, anything significant like that. That's impressive. For an app launching virtually with no problem, that does show that they've got some infrastructure behind this.
Now, how about, this is something we've been talking about for years, Steve, privacy and our personal mm-hmm. information. Is there anything about, you know, leaping onto a new platform like Threads that's going to give up more about us than we're already giving up if, say, we're just on Facebook?
No. You have to remember, this isn't a new platform. This is a spinoff mm-hmm. of Instagram. So if you're on Instagram, if you have your privacy settings set, which I'm going to say it again, people need to check their privacy settings. If you have that stuff turned on, if you've got it curated as to what you're comfortable with sharing, Threads will follow what Instagram is doing. It's not collecting anything new. It's not doing anything that Instagram isn't already doing. So if you feel safe and comfortable with Instagram, you should feel safe and comfortable with Threads. The biggest problem right now is consumers and users just do not take the time and effort to make sure their settings are set properly and that they understand what the apps are collecting and curating that information. That's up to the users. You can't complain that these companies are, like, following you around when you're not taking the time to properly set them up.
Now, let's talk about what gets served up to us by the algorithms here. Mm-hmm. I haven't done Threads yet myself. Mm-hmm. Maybe I never will. I don't know. But as you mentioned, the algorithm gives us suggested for us stuff based on our other mm-hmm. thread follows. And I see on Facebook, there's, you know, my friends, there's my groups, great. Mm-hmm. They're sponsored, all right, I know somebody's giving money there. And then they're suggested for you.
Mm-hmm.
By who? The algorithm. There, like, do we know what's in the black box that says, yeah, Rob, you got to see this?
Well, you can actually go into your account and see the listing of all the stuff that it's using to create those. Suggestions. It's actually quite fascinating to go in there and look at. If you go into your account setting, mm-hmm. you can actually see that stuff. So now, the one thing about Threads that is definitely not there, advertising. Yet. And that's why I'm also convinced this is a version one, because there's no way that this will not have advertising. But I think they want to really give people a commercial-free experience initially. Also, too, they probably need to figure out, you know, and I think it's interesting how, even though Threads is a, you know, a companion to Instagram, I'm already going through and curating my Threads account to be different from my Instagram account in terms of who I'm following, in terms of who I'm allowing to follow me. So I think that that's part of it. Is this is, I don't want to say this is a beta period, but I think that that's what they're doing, is they're letting people kind of get comfortable with it before they introduce these other features, before they introduce advertising. And also, too, I have to admit, you know, within a few minutes of setting up Threads, it was already figuring out what I like. And it was figuring out in a way that I was happy with. It was showing me stuff I actually wanted to see. And that made me impressed.
Just our last minute or so, Steve, what is on your eye that maybe isn't in the media yet in social media? What is on the horizon you're watching?
Well, the big question is, Twitter is obviously threatening to sue Threads and shut that down. I think that's just showing that Twitter is definitely terrified of this. Now, you know, Twitter doesn't have to release numbers anymore. They don't have to release subscribers now that it's privately held. But, you know, people who look at, like, data and how much internet data is going to the Twitter website, in the last 3 months, Twitter has absolutely been on a downward spiral. But the last 5 days, it has fallen off a cliff. And for anyone that's an investor, anyone that's an advertiser, this is some really shocking numbers. So my big question, what's on the horizon, is really not about Threads. It's really what's going to happen to Twitter, because it's not sustainable. So we'll see. It's either that or they're going to introduce holograms.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Knoll, digital marketing professor specializing in social media at Madison Area Technical College. He joined us to talk about the recent entry of Instagram Threads into the social media landscape. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Are you an early adopter, or are you going to wait and see, or just plain forget about it? Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a related issue, social media scams are on the rise, including on Facebook Marketplace. Find out what's going on and how to stay safe when you buy and sell stuff online. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, for thrill seekers, few attractions offer as much fun as a roller coaster. But recently, riders here in Wisconsin were stuck upside down for hours after a mechanical failure. Another spot, a huge crack in a supporting beam after he and his family had been on the ride. America's roller coaster rides today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, think of the last time you put some ice in a beverage. Probably pretty recently, given our summer heat. For me, this morning in my coffee, last night in a mocktail. Did you stop to think about how convenient it is that you have ice on demand? It's probably always been that easy to cool off a drink, right? Well, not so fast. There's a centuries-old story about how we came to use frozen water as a commodity in the U.S. and around the world. It even involves some good old-fashioned hardball business practices right here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you ever had to go without ice or without refrigeration, how did that affect you and your food and beverage choices? How do you use ice in your day-to-day life? Big fan of skating rinks, say? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Amy Brady is executive director of Orion Magazine, a contributing editor for Scientific American and co-editor of The World as We Knew It, Dispatches from a Changing Climate. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What motivated you to stop taking ice for granted and tackle it in this book?
A few years ago, there was a heat wave that gripped the planet, and I was visiting family back in my home state of Kansas. The heat wave knocked out the power into our to their house, and so we piled into their car and went to a nearby gas station that was operating on a generator. Inside, there was air conditioning, there was a soda machine, and I filled a cup with ice to try to cool down. And as I was watching that ice fall into my cup, it just occurred to me that I hadn't thought twice about whether ice would be available. I just knew if I went to that gas station, I'd find it. Or if I went the other direction to the nearby grocery store, I could have bought a bag of ice. And I wondered, why is that the case? Why is ice available everywhere? Because it really isn't in other places around the world. Well, when I got home and the air or the electricity came back on, I tried to do some research to find an answer to that question, and I couldn't find a satisfying answer. So I decided to look more in depth, and ultimately, a fascinating history of how ice on demand came to be started to reveal itself. And that was the premise for this book.
Now, back in the day, you could have ice if you were rich and lived in a place that had frozen ponds or rivers nearby. You dig into the story of the first ice entrepreneur in the United States who ends up shipping ice to the Caribbean. Can you share a little bit of his story and how he made this an actual business?
Yeah, the first person to make ice into a business, he was the person who launched the American ice trade. His name was Frederick Tudor. He was a wealthy Bostonian. Some might have called him a madman. People did call him a madman in his day. And as a late teen, and then a man in his early 20s, he landed on this idea to carve large blocks of ice out of his family's lake on their estate in Massachusetts and ship it to people who lived in warm climates around the world. And he just knew that once people got a taste of cold, they would never look back, and he would make millions of dollars. And it took years and years of trial and error, but that eventually was the case.
And it wasn't a gimme. The thing he had to do, the marketing technique he stumbled on, was to actually give ice free to bartenders, right? And say, hey, you can make cold rum drinks instead of room temperature rum drinks. How did that catch on?
That's exactly right. So one of the first places that he tried to sell ice to were people living in Cuba. And what he knew after years of failure there, he just couldn't get people to buy his ice, was that nobody in Havana trusted him, but they all trusted their local baristas. Cafe culture was dominant in Cuba. So he went to the local cafes and he said to the owners, "Look, I'm going to give you some ice for free. And that way you can use it to make these most delicious drinks. And then you can sell it to your customers at the same price as you would sell lukewarm drinks. And let's just see which one they like the best." Well, just as in today, back then, you really can't argue with a cold drink on the rocks. And people clamored for it, and he ended up making a killing.
Talking to Amy Brady about her new book, Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts on ice, its accessibility, its history. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living in Lowell, and the bartender said that there was a tunnel underneath this bar, and we thought about what it could possibly be. Then I went and did a little bit of investigation. It was a tunnel from the river up through the bar to the brewery at the top of the hill, and they would take horses and cut big blocks of ice out of the river and take them up through the tunnel all the way from the brewery down to the river, and they put hay on top of them, and then they put the beer in there, and it lasted all summer.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing that story. Now, Amy, that wasn't the only place that was happening in Wisconsin. You write of an ice war in Milwaukee, where they were supplying ice to brewers, making cold German lagers there. What ended up happening?
This is one of my favorite stories that came out of my research. So, in the early 20th century, around 1900, 1901, there was a company harvesting ice out of the Milwaukee River that went by, ironically, as the Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company. And Wisconsin Lakes was the only ice company in the region for years and years and years. But then that changed when another company came in called the Pike and North Lake Company that started harvesting ice out of Lake Michigan. Well, this was at the peak of the Industrial Revolution when rivers were really, really dirty. And so the Pike Company launched this smear campaign against Wisconsin lakes that was harvesting out of the Milwaukee River, saying that their ice was really dirty. Well, Wisconsin lakes didn't take kindly to that. So they looked at Pike Company's infrastructure to see, is there any way that we can get back at them? And sure enough, what they realized was that the Pike Company had bought land to build their ice houses close to the railroads, the same type of railroads that was probably delivering ice to that bar that your caller just talked about. But what they had failed to do was to buy the land between the ice houses and the railroads. So Wisconsin Lakes ended up buying that intermediate land area and then waited until Pike Company had harvested a bunch of ice and was ready to bring it to the railroads for delivery. And when they did that, Wisconsin Lake slapped them with a trespassing order, and all of their ice went to waste. Well, the Pike Company decided this was war. And so what they did in retaliation was really one of the best acts of revenge I think I've ever read. What they did is that they waited until that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting for their next big delivery. Now, at the time, river tourism was pretty popular. And so what Pike Company did is that they bought a steamship and sold tickets to tourists. But what separated their steamship from all the other touristy steamships is that they outfitted theirs with an icebreaker. And so right when Wisconsin Lakes was getting ready to harvest their ice, they filled the ship, they hired a band to play a jazzy tune, and as the band played, they brought their steamship right through the ice that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting, sending the ice harvesters running and breaking that valuable ice into millions of splinters. It was really like Titanic in reverse.
Pretty cold-hearted. Now, Amy, before we enter the industrial ice era, I want to check out a historical character I didn't know existed. Now, we get to a point where people have ice boxes in their house. They get ice deliveries, right into their door. And there's this iconic figure of the sexy ice man. Tell us about him.
So one of the most fascinating things I uncovered in my research was that by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when ice delivery to people's homes was reaching its peak, we also find all of these popular songs with lyrics about housewives falling in love with the Iceman. I also found these vintage Valentine's Day cards with puns about the sexy Iceman. And I was wondering, why is this? Why was this nation fascinated with Icemen? Because they weren't the only delivery men of the era. There were milkmen, there were mailmen. But what I realized is that of all the delivery people of the era, the Iceman was the only one to come inside the house to bring their product to the kitchen. And they would often come into the house when the husband was away at work. And this was a time when there was a lot of anxiety around women being alone with men who weren't their husbands. And so this created a nationwide fascination and an anxiety around the Iceman. One of my favorite cultural finds was this song that was written in the 1930s that was later popularized by Ray Charles that went something like, I'm moving to the outskirts of town and I'm buying my woman a Frigidaire so we can get rid of that Iceman.
We're talking to Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about ice, how we used to get it, what led to the era of freezers in every home? Do you rely on ice for entertainment? Maybe that skating rink, curling, for example? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Orion Magazine executive editor Amy Brady. We're talking about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're big, it turns out, on ice here in the United States. I know I am. Have you traveled to someplace where ice wasn't really a thing? What was that like for you? Or are you from outside of the United States? Are you wondering, what's our deal with all the ice? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy, the creation of artificial ice, you know, not collected from nature, it changed our beverages, our food, a lot of other things. And another, you spent a chapter or two on sports, and this really shook things up, especially in the ways that women could be out doing sports in public. Can you talk about, you know, artificial ice surfaces and how they change things?
Absolutely. So ice skating was really popular in the early 19th century, even before we had indoor skating rinks. And one of the reasons why they were so popular was because young couples could enjoy ice skating outdoors together, spending time together, without being under the watchful eye of a guardian. ice skating really was seen as the domain of young people, lest an older person fall and hurt themselves, or so went the thinking of the day. And so because it was so popular among young couples, women were encouraged to take part in the activity. And at the time, there were some, but not a lot of physical sports-like activities that women were encouraged to participate in. And so because women were ice skating, they had to consider how their garments affected their ability to stay upright on the slippery ice. And this was an era when women's skirts were very long. And so it was easy to trip on them. So they started hiking up their skirts and ultimately started buying clothing that was just a little bit shorter so that they wouldn't trip over their garments. And so in this way, ice skating led to changing social mores about women showing off their ankles and wearing shorter hemlines.
And then we had sports like curling and hockey that existed in some forms on frozen ponds before that, but the ability to create this surface, and not just when it was cold, how did it change those games?
Well, prior to indoor ice skating, sports like ice hockey and curling, though curling barely existed in the United States before indoor ice rinks. It was really just ice hockey and ice skating. Prior to the invention of indoor skating rinks, these were activities that were only experienced in northern climates where ice formed naturally. But once we had the ability to create indoor skating rinks, we could bring that popular pastime of ice skating that once only took place on, say, the Wisconsin, you know, the Milwaukee River or the Hudson, could suddenly take place in Florida or Arizona. And that radically popularized sports. You know, now there are, ice skating rinks in almost every state in the union. And there aren't a lot of sports where you can say that it's, so popular that there are spaces dedicated to it in every single state.
Your book is bookended with a change in climate. Ice becomes less available at the end of the Little Ice Age. Rivers and lakes aren't freezing as much. And now there's concern. And an irony, you write, we're using a lot of energy to make ice to help us deal with the heat, but that in turn is contributing to climate change. Can you talk about some of those concerns?
Yeah, well, the popularization of ice and the need for cold, the American need for cold, led to the rise of electric refrigeration. And today, there are approximately 110 million electric refrigerators working in the United States alone. And a majority of those refrigerators have automated ice makers, which means that the refrigerator, which is already takes a significant energy draw, draws even more energy because those automated ice makers have motors that never turn off. That's why you can have ice at any time of day or night. Well, all of that energy use is starting to take a toll on the planet. The cooling industry contributes approximately 10% of all carbon emissions, which means it's not the most significant contributor of global warming, but it's not insignificant. And as somebody who absolutely loves ice, I'm never giving up my ice. I love it. But also as somebody who believes in living as gently on the earth as I can. I was curious to learn, are there experts thinking about this problem? And are there any solutions that, you know, might be possible in my lifetime? And I was so excited to learn that there are people who are experimenting with technologies such as certain types of magnets, with a material called plastic crystals, which actually have nothing to do with plastic. It's a word that describes their structure, the molecular structure. They're learning that these materials can actually mimic the type of compression technology that more conventional refrigerators use that draw considerably less energy. And they also don't rely on the same type of traditional refrigerants that contribute to global warming that that conventional refrigerants do. So I'm very excited about this. If we can scale up that technology, that could be a game changer for the cooling industry. And gosh, if there's anything I've learned in writing this book, is that Americans can adapt new types of technology and make widespread transformations in a relatively short amount of time.
Talking to Amy Brady about her new book called Ice. Let's bring on another caller. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the subject. And about in 2019, I took a trip to Alaska. And on one of the excursions, we were served glacial ice in our drinks. And it was just so totally awesome. It was like a blue-white. And it was a great experience, yeah.
Could you tell the difference in the drink, Laura?
You know, it was just, yeah, I think it was partly just in your head. You know, you just realized it was so cold and delicious. I don't know.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. Amy, that actually that brings me around to something you spent some time in the book, the aesthetics of ice in our drinks. And there are people who argue, I think, about the best shape of ice, the best source of ice to have in our cocktails. What do we know?
Well, the shape, the size, the texture of the ice that you put in your drink can radically change the flavor. Different sizes of ice dilute at different speeds. Some ice is actually just colder than other types of ice. And then there's also the way that ice looks. Ice straight out of a conventional ice machine is a little bit cloudy in the center. And what some bartenders are thinking about is whether a clear ice can make a difference. And what their clientele is telling them is that, yeah, it does make a difference. The drink tastes better. And to my mind, it also just looks better. And so when you go to an upscale cocktail bar in this day and age, don't be surprised if the ice in your cocktail looks extra fancy. And also don't be surprised if that cocktail costs a little more than you're used to, because super clear ice is pretty expensive.
Thanks for that call, Laura. And that takes me back to something early in your book, Amy. Now, the early blocks of ice you mentioned, towed by horses. Now, I've been in marching band back in high school, and I marched in parades behind horses. I know what comes out of the back of horses. This was an issue for our ice quality back in the day, right?
Oh, boy, was it ever. So ice harvesters often employed horses to help cut the ice and then to haul it out of the lakes and rivers and into the back of wagons so that it could be delivered to people's homes. And as you say, you know, horses being the mammals that they are, often let loose their bowels on the ice, the very ice that would soon touch the mouths of thirsty Americans everywhere. And so all ice harvesting crews employed a man who would pull what was called a shine sleigh. And the job of the shine sleigh was to scrape the horse's waste off the ice so that it could be delivered. And it got its name from the oily shine that it would leave behind.
Yum. That's a great place to leave it. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can keep sharing your thoughts on ice. Do you have a favorite ice to put in a particular beverage? Let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the FDA gave full approval now to a drug that slows the progression of Alzheimer's. A Wisconsin expert on dementia joins the show for a look at the medication and what we know about prevention and treatment. And should a domestic violence restraining order prevent someone from being able to purchase a firearm? That question is now headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll find out why, look at the individual case that's taking it there, and then what's at stake when they rule on it in the months to come. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.